Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hundreds of state workers could potentially be suspended without pay. And this is as of today because Governor Baker's vaccine mandate is now officially in place, which means that the roughly 42,000 Massachusetts workers who are issued paychecks by the executive branch now have to be vaccinated against COVID-19. The mandate is stronger than many others. There's no option to forego the vaccine in favor of regular testing, although there is a process for religious or medical exemptions. This is a developing story. Today we heard from the State Police Union warning that suspending troopers would be bad for public safety.
The danger to our staffing and to our already overburdened workforce is significant.
That was Police Union President Michael Shervin at a news conference on Boston Common this morning. Here to break it all down for us is WBUR's Callum Borchers. Callum, welcome back.
Good to be back, TCI.
So, Callum, we are talking about really critical services here that people rely on. And let's stick with the Massachusetts State Police today. That's who we heard from just a second ago. What else did you hear at the press conference earlier?
Well, we heard some solid numbers for a change. That was nice. The union estimates about 300 state troopers are unvaccinated, which is about 15% of the force. And out of that, 200 have applied for vaccine waivers, and the vast majority of them, Tiziana, are seeking religious exemptions. A few are also asking for exemptions on medical grounds. I want to share an exchange, though, that I had with the union president, Michael Shervin, who we heard a moment ago, because I think this is key. I asked him whether he accepts that an unvaccinated trooper puts the public at greater risk than a trooper who is vaccinated, and here's how he responded.
We all know that the vaccination doesn't prevent you from catching it and transmitting it.
It does reduce that, though.
It
right?
does reduce it. As we saw today, unfortunately, may he rest in peace, General Colin Powell, vaccinated and has passed. But that's not a vaccination is not 100% prevention from transmitting it. And again, we are pro-vaccination. We're also pro-labor.
So, just to reiterate my pushback there, the COVID vaccines dramatically reduce illness and transmission rates. But the State Police Union and other unions are pointing to some of these breakthrough cases like Colin Powell's to argue against vaccine mandates. I'll point out, though, Tiziana, this hasn't been a winning argument in court, however, which we can get into. But, nothing is perfect. A trooper's gun doesn't provide total protection either, but they still carry sidearms, of course. So the fact that vaccines aren't perfect didn't sway a judge when the police union challenged the governor's mandate recently.
Okay, so that's a particular example here. Let's step back now. I mentioned earlier the vaccine mandate applies to roughly 42,000 workers across the state. How many are already vaccinated and how many aren't at this point?
Well, we don't know exactly, but clearly the vast majority are vaccinated. The Baker administration says about 95% are vaccinated or have applied for exemptions. So they're grouping those two categories together, which is why we don't know the exact breakdown, Tiziana. But we believe only about 2% of the overall executive branch workforce is seeking these waivers. And that's one of the major labor unions, the SEIU 509, talked to me last week, and they said the administration tells them that's about the number. That would be maybe 800 or so workers.
So let's talk about these exemptions. What is the process like? Is it easy to get an exemption? Will very few people get them?
The state hasn't said what the acceptance rate is, in part because they're still evaluating those applications. But we do know that they're considered on a case-by-case basis. There's no set list of medical conditions or religious beliefs that automatically qualify. There are several dozen HR specialists who are handling these applications, and they may ask to see medical records. They might want to interview your doctor or your faith leader. And this is leading to some consternation among these unions. I mentioned SEIU Local 509. They represent DCF social workers, some other social service employees. They're generally supportive of the vaccine mandate, Tiziana, but their president, Peter McKinnon, told me the waiver application process is flawed.
One agency maybe is applying this set of criteria for exemption requests, whereas another agency is applying a different set of criteria. And it shouldn't be that way.
So you hear the frustration there. But on the other hand, some jobs are more public-facing than others. And so also some variation may be understandable.
So just briefly on the religious exemptions, Callum, we have seen a lot of controversy, concerns about gaming the system around religious exemptions. What can you tell us?
Right. I mean, it's complicated, of course, because you have people proclaiming they have a sincerely held religious belief. The principal objection that you hear is that cell lines from aborted fetuses were used in the development of some of the vaccines, although not all. But on the other hand, the Catholic Church and some other major faith groups have said, despite those concerns, it is morally acceptable to get the vaccine. So that's sort of where the tension lies.
Okay, so we've already seen some legal challenges fail. Does that mean the state's on pretty solid legal footing here at this point?
They would seem to be, in part because, this is not a sweeping mandate for all people. There's nobody saying that you as a private citizen have to go get the mandate. What they're saying is that if you want to do this job as a public servant, you have to get a mandate. And so there may be more legal challenges to come. But as you noted, the state police union lost its challenge. We also saw a similar challenge from the Department of Corrections. They were asking for injunctions that would delay enforcement of this mandate. And in both cases, they have lost.
So, Callum, I'm just going to clarify. I'm sorry. You said you have to get a mandate. Did you mean waiver there or mandate?
Get a waiver. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
You have to get a waiver to get out of the mandate. But so far, the mandates are holding up in court by and large.
Okay. And what will you be watching for moving forward, Callum?
Well, I think we want to see some more data from the state as far as what's the acceptance rate on these exemption requests. And we also want to know the particulars of those exemption requests. So we've submitted a public records request to the state for copies of these applications, both medical and religious. Of course, they would redact the individuals involved for privacy reasons. But I think we'd want to know, on what grounds are people asking for these exemptions, and what is their success rate? And I think that will give a lot of insight into how the state is considering this very thorny human resources issue.
It really does feel like history and precedent are unfolding before us. Glad to be following it with you. That's WBUR's Callum Borchers. Cal, thanks.
Always glad to be with you.
All right, so turning to another major story that we at WBUR are covering today. Last week, WBUR uncovered an incident involving Boston police's arrest of Al Copeland back in 2019. Copeland, who was black, was in the driver's seat of a car, pulled over, barely conscious. Police arrested him for being drunk, and it was hours before they called him an ambulance. It turns out he was having a stroke and, as a recovering alcoholic, had not had a drink since 1995. Now, here with more on this story, WBUR's Allie Jarmanning. Allie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Allie, who is Al Copeland? Tell us about him.
Yeah, Al is 64 years old. He lives in Mattapan with his wife, Valerie. She is a pastor. And the two of them met at church in 2007. And they are a blended family with three kids between them. And one of the things they love is trying out new restaurants together. And recovery is a big part of Al's life. He's been sober for more than 25 years, as you mentioned, and helps others as a recovery coach. And in his professional life, he worked in the employee assistance unit at the T. And one thing to know about Al, he is a no-nonsense kind of guy, and he does not hold back when it comes to speaking his mind, which I really appreciate.
So, of course, the details there, Allie, really sort of set in relief what happened to him back in 2019. So remind us what that was.
Yeah, so Al was driving on Mass Ave in Boston when he started to feel nauseous, and he knew he couldn't keep driving, so he pulled over right in front of the Berklee College of Music. So here's how Al described that to me.
Because I was afraid, I say, well, at least if anything happened to me, somebody will find me.
And Al didn't know it then, but he was having a stroke, and someone did find him, the Boston police. At that point, Al was slumped behind the wheel and barely conscious, but instead of calling an ambulance, the police arrested him. The police brought Al back to the station where he could barely stand. At one point, officers left him in a holding cell, and he fell and hit his head on a wall. They finally called an ambulance after Al vomited, and that was 5 hours after they first found him in his car.
Okay, what do we know about why the police determined that he was intoxicated versus sick and chose to arrest him?
Right. So the police wrote in their incident report that they could smell alcohol. Remember, though, Al says he hasn't had a drink since 1995. His wife, Valerie, thinks she knows why they made that assumption.
Why they didn't assume he was sick? I can only, and I strongly believe, it's because he's a black male. I think if he had been a 62-year-old white man passed out in front of Berklee School of Music, I think they would have called an ambulance.
And we'll come back, Allie, to you know, sort of the claims with the Boston Police Department in just a minute. But let's stay with Al that day first. What happened once he got to the hospital?
Well, it didn't get any better. Police records show that Tufts Medical Center providers also assumed Al was drunk, and they left him in the emergency room for 7 more hours. It was only when Valerie tracked her husband down, did doctors confirm he didn't have any alcohol or drugs in his system, and they realized he'd had a stroke.
So she had to go find her husband, Allie?
Yeah, she called around and was able to find him, and he was unable to communicate, and she was the first one to be able to communicate with the medical providers on his behalf.
Okay, has Tufts said anything about all this?
So they cited patient confidentiality and wouldn't speak to me about Al's care specifically, but they did apologize for what happened to him, and they have made some changes. They added a social worker to assist patients who can't speak for themselves, people like Al, and created a diversity and equity center to reduce disparities in care.
Okay, so I want to ask now we go back to the Boston police. The city reaches a settlement with Al. It was a $1.3 million settlement. How'd they get there? Did the family sue?
So they were getting ready to. Al and Valerie got a lawyer and were preparing to file a lawsuit. And part of that process is sending a letter to the city about what happened, basically putting them on notice. And most of the time when a city gets the letter like that, a lawsuit is eventually filed, and that's how we find out about it. But not in this case. So remember the timing. George Floyd was killed in May 2020, and there were a lot of hard questions being asked about how the police department in Boston and elsewhere treats people of color. And so in the midst of all that last summer, the city paid Al $1.3 million, avoiding a lawsuit and any publicity.
Did the police department investigate what happened?
So they did, and that's after the Copeland's lawyer reached out to the city. The department did an internal affairs investigation and did eventually fault 3 officers involved, but not for the arrest or thinking Al was drunk. Instead, investigators cited them for what's called neglect of duty, because when Al fell in the cell, nobody was watching him, and so he was left on the floor for about a minute.
And any discipline for those officers?
Not yet. Discipline still hasn't been handed down, even though it's been more than a year since the investigation wrapped.
Okay, and to be clear, there is a settlement. Does that mean there is an admission of error?
No. No fault was admitted, which is pretty common in a settlement like this.
So we are glad, obviously, Allie, that Al survived the incident. I understand there were some lasting effects. Talk about that, about how the night and what happened impacted the whole family.
Yeah, I mean, Al spent weeks in the hospital, and he doesn't remember a lot of that. He just woke up in rehab, wondering what happened. Really had many weeks and months of stress trying to hope that her husband was going to recover. And Al is better than in those early days, but he's still really affected. So here is how he puts it.
A lot of it with my balance, my attitude, my appetite, tasting food, and some cognitive things that are still happening. You know, and some physical things as well.
It's hard for him to even walk across his backyard without holding on to something or to even enjoy a meal with his wife.
So, Allie, this all comes as the Boston Police Department is facing multiple scandals. And also, we hear, as we near next month's mayoral election, I know both candidates have condemned the actions by, you know, taken that night. Have you seen or heard anything that would lead you to believe significant actions will be taken as a result of this incident?
So, not yet. And one thing that's really telling to me is that nobody has reached out to Al or Valerie since this happened. Not since 2019 and not since we covered it this last week. You know, talking to Valerie since the story first ran, she's glad that what happened is on the candidate's radar, but she's really worried they're going to treat it like a one-off. And so she has a suggestion for whoever wins in November. Meet with her husband, hear his story, and then do something.
Okay, that is WBUR's Allie Germanning. Allie, thanks.
Thank you.
You are a kid in the school cafeteria. your parent or guardian has fallen behind on paying your school meal account. You go to checkout with your hot lunch, and it's taken away right there in line, and you get a cold sandwich instead. That is called meal shaming, and as of last Friday, it's no longer legal in Massachusetts. The move is part of a larger bill on meals in schools that Governor Charlie Baker signed into law. There is a lot, folks, going on around school meals right now, from increased need and demand to federal funds that make it possible for all kids in a school district to eat free in some cases, and then to massive supply chain shortages that are throwing food programs into disarray, even as kids need that nutrition more and they need support in their learning during an ongoing pandemic. So we're going to kind of take stock of the whole situation, starting with Carrie Young, our senior education reporter here at WBUR. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Carrie, I want to just ask you, was lunch shaming a widespread phenomenon here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, I mean, so I think I wouldn't say that the numbers are insignificant, but, you know, they weren't one-offs either. The last comprehensive report that I saw on this came from the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute in 2018. So it is a few years old, but at that time, they found that 28 districts had policies where students just don't eat if they don't have money. They also found that more than 60 elementary and middle schools did have those punitive measures for students with school lunch debts. And there were about 24 districts who actually hired a debt collection agency to deal with school meal debt. So again, you know, these aren't one-offs. But to put it into context, it wasn't a majority of school districts either. There are about 400 districts in Massachusetts. So it was definitely an issue, though.
And would you say that the example that I just gave was pretty representative of what a meal shaming would look like?
Yeah, I mean, the cold sandwich, kind of throwing away the hot meal, is one that you hear about a lot. But there are other things, too, like you know, making it so that the student can't go on a field trip or some kind of like extracurricular activity at school, or even, I know I've heard of schools keeping students from walking at graduation. So there's a lot of punitive measures that I have heard of from schools that have happened over school lunch debt, some kind of debt that is not the student's responsibility. It's between the adults.
Okay, so let's juxtapose that with the level of need right now, Carrie, especially maybe give us a before and after with the pandemic.
Yeah, well, so I think the biggest number or the best representative number here is the number of families that are turning to SNAP benefits, and that is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And since February of 2020, there's been a more than 20% increase in the number of households that are participating in Massachusetts. So that's a pretty significant increase. So I would say, you know, with the pandemic and all of the disruptions it had, you know, whether it was, you know, just socially and emotionally, but also economically, it had a huge impact on the need for school meals.
And tell us a little bit about the supply chain issues that we're also seeing right now.
Oh, yeah. School meals are not immune to these supply chain problems. Schools have been having a hard time predicting when things like plastic utensils, I know that's a big one, disposable plates, things like that might come in. There's definitely enough, but your child might be using a spork instead of a spoon for applesauce, is one example I heard. You know, other times it's ingredients too. So there is definitely enough food, but maybe you were expecting a certain type of spice or tomato sauce or whatever it might be. The supply chain issues are just making it so that, you know, predicting when a shipment might come in is going to be really hard. So that's last minute menu changes and things like that. Also, there's a truck driver shortage that's all part of this supply chain problem. And so one thing, districts had been used to getting all of their food delivered to each of their buildings for the most part. I guess that depends on the district, but I have heard of at least one district who did have their meal or their food delivered to each individual school, but now it's all going to one school because that's the only truck driver they could get, and then they're individually going to that school and bringing it in. So it's affected a lot.
So Carrie, I'm about to bring in two other voices, but just very briefly before I do, tell us what else was in the bill the governor signed.
Yeah, outside of that banning of shaming tactics, which was huge, it also requires that schools where a majority of students who come from low-income families, they have to enroll the school in a federal program that provides free breakfast and lunch to all students. Now, it does offer a waiver to get out of that, but in order to even vote on having that waiver in the school committee, districts also have to sign up for a class to learn more about those federal programs. So they have to actually do some work to really be able to say we can't do this.
Okay, Carrie Young, sit tight. I will come back to you in a few minutes. Right now, I want to bring in an advocate and a school leader. We have Aaron McAleer, president and CEO of Project Bread, which is a nonprofit focused on connecting people to reliable food sources and advocating for equitable food policies, and John Cabral, superintendent of the Taunton Public Schools here in Massachusetts. Aaron, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on.
And Superintendent Cabral, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. May I call you John?
Of course.
Okay, John, how many meals has the Taunton Public Schools served roughly since the start of the pandemic?
Since the start of the pandemic, dating back to March 13th when we sent our students home, roughly over 600,000 meals were distributed to locations throughout our community to ensure that families and students did not go without.
And 600,000 meals, how many kids?
We have 8,000 students in our school district prior to the pandemic, and right now with the full return as we begin to recover post-pandemic, we're still hovering around 8,000, so give or take 8,000 students. But we also made sure any students attending the city vocational school, any student attending parochial schools that were open at the time, as well as the agricultural school in the town next door, any student who went to one of these sites that was hosted at a school or hosted at strategic areas throughout the community, if a family showed up looking for meals, they were not turned away and no questions were asked.
All right, I'll go to Aaron in just a second. But John, 600,000 feels like a massive number to me. Am I right?
It dwarfs in comparison to some of my neighbors in surrounding area urban districts. So I think about my colleagues in New Bedford, Fall River, my hometown, got to give a plug, in New Bedford. When you put our four school systems together, student-wise, we're about the size of Boston. So if I distributed 600,000 meals, I'm sure those communities are north of 600,000.
And Aaron, what to think about that? What's the conclusion you want us to draw from what John just told us?
School meals are essential. I mean, this crisis exposed that in the beginning when schools closed and we realized how many kids across the state had been relying on school meals. For low-income kids, over half their daily calories can come from school meals. And that's the conclusion. And we need to make sure that these meals are accessible for all. John gave great data for his district. You know, another important thing to point out is that the U.S. Census did monthly surveys throughout this pandemic, and school meals were the number one source of free food for families in Massachusetts. SNAP, which Carrie referenced, was the number one anti-hunger program, but school meals were the number one source of free food. So they're critical in the work against hunger here in our state.
Okay, so I'm going to work with the two of you. We're going to get wonky for just a second, because as I understand it, during the pandemic, there is federal funding that allows a school district to provide free meals to everyone. John, am I understanding that correctly, and are you doing that in Taunton?
Correct. We meet the criteria. So I have an outstanding food service director, and she knows how I feel, how I felt about food shaming. And if we could eliminate food shaming and also provide the students in our community with healthy, nutritious meals, at no cost, then it was a no-brainer for us to go with the program, to utilize the program, and to keep assessing our data to the point which we qualify. So it's a great program in the sense that our students, when they come into school in the morning, they receive a healthy, nutritious breakfast, whether it's a grab-and-go or whether it's breakfast in the classroom. Our students, K through 12, are receiving a healthy, nutritious breakfast to start the day every day. And then when it comes to lunch, salad bars, different choices with drinks, hot meals, cold meals. We provide a wide range of food that meets the health standards that have been set forth by state and national agencies. So I'm very proud of the work that we've done here in Taunton, but more so I'm proud of the work that's being done by our urban communities. We are the fabric of many of our communities. A lot of our parents, a lot of the agencies in the cities and towns that we represent look to us during a time of need. So for school departments to be able to step up and work collaboratively with our partners on the city, you know, to take care of our great cities, it's a win-win all around, and it really goes to demonstrate how schools are ingrained in the social fabric of their communities.
So with that in mind, Aaron, Governor Baker signs a bill that says, essentially says that if a school district has a certain percentage of kids who qualify for free meals, then the district needs to provide free meals to everyone. But you'd like to go even further than that, and you're advocating for legislation that would go further, correct?
That's correct. So right now in Massachusetts, but also across the country, we have universal free school meals. And that's because of a federal waiver from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that was, you know, passed as part of the pandemic. That is going to expire at the end of this school year. So there are many districts that will continue to provide universal free school meals, like Taunton. And thank you so much for your leadership in that community. But in other communities, they will not. So the purpose of this legislation is for those communities where, as you said, over 50% of kids are low income. We are heavily encouraging them, mandating them to apply for the community eligibility provision that would ensure that there are universal free school meals in those districts. But where Project Bread would like to go even further is for us just to have universal free school meals for every single kid in Massachusetts. Both Maine and California have already said that they will continue this program, and that's what we're also advocating for at Project Bread.
And John, what would it mean for the kids in your district if meals were just permanently free?
I think it'd be it's a huge relief for parents to know that they have that choice. When we look at the demographics in my community, how it's changing in southeastern Massachusetts, knowing that a lot of families sometimes make difficult decisions, or have to make difficult choices when it comes to, you know, a simple thing, something that we take for granted like food. So to be able to take that burden off our families while also ensuring that our students are receiving healthy, nutritious meals, to me, it just makes a lot of sense. And if we can do that one thing in our community, you know, to help our kids come to school, have a healthy breakfast, learn, have a healthy lunch, and continue learning into the afternoon, and in some cases, sending them home with meals, I just think it goes a long way in helping to better our community.
So last couple of questions for you. Aaron, now we talked about these supply chain disruptions. From an advocacy standpoint, what I want to understand is somebody not doing something right, or are we just in a gnarly, gnarly situation here?
We are in a gnarly situation. I mean, there's always been supply chain challenges, so it's not new. And as Carrie said, you know, kids are getting fed. So there's no worry that your kid will not have school lunch when they get there. They might have a menu swap. It might be that they were going to have a certain type of chicken and that spice isn't available, so they're having a different one. But yeah, I mean, the global supply chain challenges are impacting every single part of our, you know, economy, and school meals are part of that as well.
So John, when I hear that, what I worry about is you have emphasized just now, John, pretty significantly the importance of the nutrition that kids are getting in these meals. And I wonder, with supply chain and ingredients disruptions, Carrie Young, you heard her say there's still plenty of food, but should we be worried that there is a nutritional impact and therefore potentially a learning impact for kids in these disruptions? Or is that sort of, am I overly concerned?
I wouldn't say you're overly concerned, but it's something that I think we need to watch and be mindful of. I know when I speak with my food service director, and we did send a communication out to our families 2 weeks ago when we had to make some menu changes, because we do want our families, one, who have students with specific dietary needs, to be aware of what's on the menus in case they need to make adjustments. Students with potential allergies, so families or have to count their calories, we want to make sure that our families are informed and know what the changes are. But I don't believe we're at that point yet. I don't think the supply chain issues that we're hearing across all fields, all areas, have impacted the point where we're not serving, or we're going to be in a predicament when it comes to serving healthy, nutritious meals. I think right now, it just takes additional planning and being able to pivot on a dime should you get wind that a certain supply is not going to be available, or having those vendors in your back pocket so
so that if there is a shortage of milk or there is a shortage of chicken nuggets or pizza poppers, as one of my superintendent colleagues mentioned to me, that they can reach out to that vendor and quickly get something else on the menu or something similar or comparable on the menu, because I'm really concerned about the dietary needs of our family, especially our medically fragile students.
So, Aaron, just briefly, how do we get to the point where we don't need your advocacy and where John isn't worried about the nutrition of kids in the schools?
I mean, universal free school meals is necessary. It is, you know, there's no pathway to ending childhood hunger without universal free school meals. So it's advocating with Project Bread to make this permanent. It's participating if you're a parent right now, participating in school meals. The more kids who eat school meals, the more revenue that goes back into the district to purchase healthier foods, to hire more staff. And just, I just want to give a huge shout out to school nutrition staff across the state, because they've been pivoting since March of 2020 in this crisis, and their goal, they're in this job to feed kids. So I just want to make sure people know, most of them, that is their mission, is to feed kids. And they've been incredible. And now they're facing this supply chain issue on top of everything else.
All right. Aaron McAleer is president and CEO of Project Bread. John Cabral is superintendent of Taunton Public Schools. Aaron, John, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thank you.
Okay, so WBUR education reporter Carrie Young is still with us. Carrie, welcome back. How about some reactions to what you just heard?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that really strikes me is, just hearing how much effort goes into getting food on those school meal plates every day. As far as the planning goes, you know, you've got to know what's coming in and being able to plan which days they're going on. And when some of that predictability goes out the window, it's also taking those giant steps of like finding other vendors, knowing what it costs, being able to compare the nutrition, because that's such a big part of the planning too. That really struck me. And then something Aaron mentioned about the level of importance that school meals play in a family's life, that it's, you know, outside of SNAP, it's the number one source of free food. And without that, as we saw in the pandemic when school buildings had shut down, that families were really scrambling. And so I think it's just sort of the magnitude of both serving the food, but then also what role that plays in the family's lives.
So I want to stay on that for a second, Carrie, because what you just said strikes me. We've just spent several minutes now talking about this in the context of kids. But what you're saying is the kids are in the context of a family. And this is essentially for family health and family strategy as well. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, if a family doesn't have to budget for even just a couple of dollars every day for a school meal, that makes a big difference when it comes to like buying school supplies or paying for an electric bill. It just frees up a little bit more so that the family can make ends meet. And, you know, by not having that school lunch shaming, it takes off some of the stress that the child felt when they don't have, control over their family budget necessarily. So a lot of this legislation that is happening will, it seems like it might ease a lot of those stresses on families altogether. Like you said, it does come down to that family unit that this impacts.
So, Carrie, what are you going to keep an eye on going forward now?
Yeah, those supply chain issues, it seems like it's a big deal and it's not going away anytime soon. And so I think I'll be monitoring that, making sure, seeing, if that grows to something bigger, that nutritious meals might be in short supply, although it sounds like that is not at all the case right now. But keeping an eye on, if that happens or not, or if we get close to that, but then also labor shortages. Schools are not immune to the labor shortages we've seen across the economy. It's not just bus drivers. I know they've been making the news a lot, but it's cafeteria staff and other really important positions. So that's one thing I'm diving into right now.
All right. That is Carrie Young. Was and is, Carrie. It's both you. Senior education reporter at WBUR. It's always great to have you on, Carrie. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In this next segment, we are going to talk about a lot of things that might make you uncomfortable, from the form and function of an inner uterine device to why birthing furniture is something you probably don't even know about. Now, the discomfort is the point, but not because we want to make you uncomfortable, but the fact that our deep cultural squeamishness about birth and reproduction has meant that we have not publicly turned a critical eye to the way that products and processes are designed around them. And we're going to talk about that. We are welcoming the authors of a new book called Designing Motherhood, Things That Make and Break Our Births. And in it, design historians Michelle Miller-Fisher and Amber Winnick examine dozens of objects and people and actions connected with birth and with motherhood. Their hope is to raise awareness of and critical thinking about these objects and our sort of collective understanding of this universal experience. Michelle and Amber join me now to talk more about designing motherhood. Michelle, Amber, welcome. Michelle, let's start with you. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us. We're delighted to be here.
Great to have you. And Amber, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
All right, so there are so many objects and stories in this book to explore, but I really want to give our listeners a flavor here. So I want to start with the story of Margaret Crane, the inventor of the home pregnancy test, because this story kind of knocked me off my feet. So Amber, was that you who just said yes?
No, Michelle.
Okay, yes. Michelle, tell us the story. Tell us that story.
Sure thing. And I think Amber and I would both say yes to that one. So Meg Crane was a young graphic designer. Not many people think of a designer as somebody who would have originated the home pregnancy test. But she worked for a pharmaceutical company called Organon in the late 60s, early 70s. It was headquartered in New York. She was in New Jersey. She was in New York. And one day she was walking through the labs that were attached to her offices, and she asked a colleague of hers what was going on with the test tubes that she saw in front of her. And he said, oh, those are pregnancy tests, they're urine samples. They're being tested, they'll take a couple of weeks, and they'll get back to doctor's offices, and doctors will tell potentially pregnant people the status of their bodies. And she looked at them and she thought, you know, I think, you know, they could probably do that themselves. And so she said, I'm going to design something that would allow this to be packaged, which was her specialty, and put on the market as an over-the-counter. At that time, it was pretty impossible to be able to find anything out about your pregnancy status on your own. You had to go to a doctor's office. It would take a couple weeks for the test to come back to you. And this is also pre-Roe v. Wade. So potentially pregnant people really didn't have the agency that they maybe do today, although, of course, in very timely news, that's now being challenged again. Anyway, cut to her proposing this to her superiors. They told her, don't be silly. We don't want to lose the business that we have with doctor's offices. And probably women wouldn't be able to do this themselves anyway. She persisted. And so she created a prototype. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to her, her superiors had gone to their parent company in the Netherlands, gotten some funding, done some prototyping themselves. She got wind of the meeting that this was going to happen at. She walked in before the outside design and advertising company came into the room, and she put her prototype down next to three others that inexplicably all had, you know, either pink tassels or bows on them, things that had absolutely nothing to do with testing for pregnancy. Hers was in this beautiful, clear Perspex oblong box. She'd used something that had been containing her paper clips, actually, on her desk as her test prototype. Long story short is that the ad executive came in, looked down the table, picked up hers and said, well, of course, this is the prototype that we're going to take to market. And they did. It took a couple of years for it to be brought to market in the U.S. It was earlier on the market in the U.K. and Canada because there was not so much lobbying in the U.S. Doctors lobbied very hard not to let women have this agency over the counter rather than in their offices. And the lovely part or end of that story is that Meg Crane ended up marrying and working with that advertising executive who became her husband, and they formed a design agency together in New York for many years. She's still in New York, still designing, and her wonderful prototype is now in the collection of the Smithsonian.
So incredible story. And I want to pick up on two things there. First, you mentioned Roe v. Wade. And I'm going to set a boundary here because, one, we've talked about Roe v. Wade. We've talked about the abortion debate before on the show. I'm sure we will again. Today, I want to stay in the design space. And so I'm sort of carving that out both for our listeners and here because I don't want it to take attention away from the other part of that story. And Amber, I'll turn to you here. Part of the reason we wanted to bring that story out, it is an idea of a woman in the room taking power, taking back power, and claiming, hey, we can do this, right, for ourselves. And in fact, having to kind of engage in espionage, right, to get the right to design something that was her idea. So talk about this idea of taking power for oneself and how it translates through some of the designs, the objects that you talk about, their designs in this book, and whether they were really designed with women and healthy reproduction in mind.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the pregnancy test is an excellent example of all of what you just mentioned. One of the other objects that we profile in the book is a booklet designed for birthing people in the 1950s called Adventure to Motherhood, which charts the story of a new first-time mother and her journey through an obstetrician's office and birthing in the hospital. And what she has to go through in order to confirm her pregnancy is a manual exam. Cut to the ability to test one's pregnancy at home in privacy. I mean, it's revolutionary.
So a couple of things. One, I was really fascinated in this book as I went through it, because so much of it felt, as a woman who has had two babies, right, who has her own lived experience here, I felt like in some ways this book was for me. And then there were other times I was so uncomfortable and kind of wanting to almost push back on you, you know, like, what are you trying to do to me here? And so I want to just kind of lay that in front of you as a reader of the book, understanding that there are two art exhibits associated with this, et cetera. Did you want me to feel that way?
We wanted people to feel connected to it in some way, and that can be through discomfort or through sort of questioning maybe preconceived notions people have or fixed notions that they think they might have about the arc of human reproduction. Everybody has been born. Everybody actually has a stake in these designs, whether they think they have or not. Amber has three children. I have no children. And so we have a range of different chapters and visual essays and interviews with people who have a range of experiences. We always say that the universality is that is everybody has been born. The uniqueness is every single birth story. And so while I have a connection to birth because I have been born myself, and I have a connection to mothering because I've done care work, I've nannied, I don't have a biological birth story of somebody coming out of my own uterus. And so I think, you know, we are hoping that people find in some way a connection to this particular topic, because in some way they will have been touched by a design somewhere within these pages, probably more than one.
And Amber, you are very clear in the book, the two of you are, calling out sort of our history of both a male interpretation of what reproduction and birth and motherhood is, and also a white interpretation of what reproduction and birth and motherhood is. And you explore those biases, how they've affected design, both of products and processes. Talk about that.
Absolutely, in every single way. And, you know, I mean, it's so interesting to hear that you did have those moments of discomfort. And while I think we set out to give everybody a way in to their story, I think a lot of the stories that are most dominant in our culture through film and, you know, what's acceptable conversation are not necessarily the stories of Black people, you know, women who have had a range of birthing experiences, whether those are positive or negative. People who have miscarried, lost children, adopted children. So, I mean, we really do run the gamut, and a lot of these stories aren't necessarily pretty at first glance.
You know, when I hear you say...
I think it's important... I wanted to say, too, I think it's important for us to mention at this juncture our amazing thought partners, Maternity Care Coalition. They really have been at the heart of us being able to authentically create a platform in this book for many different people's stories. We have over 50 different contributors to the book. And Maternity Care Coalition as an organization has been working in Philadelphia for the last 40 years to think about maternal and infant health through services that go directly to people who might not otherwise be able to access them, so birth advocacy, lactation, education, et cetera. And we know in this country, I think many people know the statistics that birthing outcomes, either as a birthing person or as an infant newly born into the world, that birthing outcomes are stratified based on many different intersections, but certainly on racialized experiences and on socioeconomic experiences. So yes, we don't look at a predominantly white experience because that is not the story of human reproduction and designed for it.
And as I listen to you, that kind of comes together, for example, with the interview that you do with Thomas Beatty, an advocate of transgender and sexuality issues. He describes his own experiences getting pregnant and giving birth to his children. He talks about the incredibly hostile environment in which he felt he did that and the public response to it. And I feel like I'm hearing the two of you say that part of what you are trying to do in this book is helping the widest range of people possible feel seen for the way in their lives they have connected with, in any of a myriad ways, the birth experience.
I think it's also that we're yes to that in a way, but also we're trying to make sense of the fact or bring people into the fact that design is objects, but it's also systems and people. There is no such thing as good design or bad design. There's only the people around it. And so while, yes, you know, on the surface, the book looks at objects, it looks at systems, and people make systems. And so it looks at those constructions and the things that Thomas went through on his journey to become a father and to give birth to his children were cultural constructions around language, around the way the medical system worked. And so I think that's really important to us. Not only should people see themselves in this book, but they should see that design is backed up by and constructed by people as a field or as a discipline or as an area of practice.
So
people are at the heart of both of those things.
We're running low on time, but I want to say you said a second ago there is no such thing as good design or bad design, and you were placing it in a larger context. But Amber, I'll turn to you. There were some bad designs in that book.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about Thomas Beatty and the fact that he couldn't be named as a father on the birth certificate, despite the fact that that's how he identified and was a birthing person. That's a very simple design solution, but there was a lot of pushback and violence in the choice to not enable him to do that. And yes, there is bad design throughout the book. I mean,
like the Dalkon shield.
Yes, the Dalkon shield, which caused pelvic inflammatory disease and it ruined the lives of many, many women. Birthing furniture that, you know, is limiting in terms of how people are able to bring their babies in the world. I mean, there are many, many examples of bad design. And I think that's something that we're proud of, is we didn't just look at the real champions of design, but really ran the gamut and kind of took a critical lens to all of them.
All right. The book is Designing Motherhood, Things That Make and Break Our Births. We've been speaking with Michelle Miller Fisher, and that was just Amber Winnick, authors of that book. Michelle, thanks.
Thank you for having us.
And Amber, thanks to you, too.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Happy Monday. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.